Welcome to the 117th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 50 years to the week that New Zealand won their first ever test series following a drawn test with Pakistan. It had taken them 39 years. Welcome to the podcast that's used to waiting for success.
Now, waiting is something that we make Reverse Swept Radio listeners do a fair bit, actually. And this time, our excuse of the length of time since the last episode is time zones, I think, really. It's now 11 hours between London and Sydney. So Andy is currently Friday night, beer in hand. Have you got a beer?
I have got beer in hand, indeed.
Great. And I'm Saturday morning, coffee in hand. And as we all know, there can be quite a difference between Friday nights with beer in hand and Saturday morning with coffee in hand. So this is just a social experiment as much as anything else this episode. We are going to be talking as ever about the recent happenings in the world of both international and smaller scale cricket. We're going to be exploring the curious world of cricket memorabilia. And we're going to be reviewing and maybe revealing the autobiography of Graham Fowler called Absolutely Foxed. Now, it's mid-November, which means the English season has been drawing to a close, and you've been celebrating in style, Andy.
Yeah, so my cricket club tends to take a bit of time to get round to our end of season due. I think maybe there's a bit of strategy to it. You don't want to do it like the week after the season, because at that point you're kind of all sick of each other. You want to give it a bit of a time. So we recently did our end of season due. We often have pizzas in the pavilion for dinner, but this year we upgraded to the dizzying heights of Chutney Jack's Curry House. From there, we headed to the heart of Maidenhead High Street to an almighty Wetherspoon pub named The Bear. And it was a great reminder about what it is when you socialise with teammates, because there were a few polite inquiries about each other's lives, families, jobs, etc. You know, the kind of thing that we're all supposed to do as fully grown, socially adjusted adults. But the reality was, you know, let everyone have a couple of beers, and all anyone really wanted to do was review and reminisce about seasons past. Everyone could not get bored about talking about cricket, even to the most sort of futile, minute detail of a, you know, failed innings from a couple of years ago. And it was a great reminder about how valuable the memories of those summer Sundays are when you're on a cold, wet winter night.
There's something wonderful as well about the fact that cricket teams throw together people who ordinarily would never come into contact with one another, which is probably why it's sometimes quite awkward when you do try and talk about just kind of normal, polite conversation, you know, things that you talk about with your friends. Really, the reason you're all there is for the cricket. And suddenly you discover, and I've certainly been in a situation of discovering, you know, at the end of season when you go to the pub with someone, that the person you've been standing next to in the slips or something all year has just gone through a divorce, or in fact they've just had their third child and you just never knew. And it is that very curious social dynamic, isn't there, that there is within a cricket team.
I think it's often because for many people cricket is the escape from that stuff. I think
exactly.
That's it, you know, exactly your example of the person who's gone through the divorce, or maybe even the person who's had the child. Actually, cricket's where they go to not talk about that or not think about that. And I think you're also completely right about the common ground. I mean, cricket and I guess many other sports teams throw together people of a shared interest, but not always, you know, shared class, shared profession or whatever. And I think you're quite right that sometimes some of the more free-reign social conversations can be awkward, because you're having to kind of feel for appropriate common ground, whereas with cricket, yes, it's always easy. And you've been close this week to what I guess has been seen as quite a step forward for Australian cricket in terms of how, I guess, in terms of how the players are seen and in terms of how the players see themselves.
Yeah, it's been interesting watching the development of the public perception of Australian cricket ever since almost going back to the death of Phil Hughes, which kind of had this real outpouring around cricket and how we see cricketers within the nation, through to then sandpaper gate, as it's come to be amusingly known, and what the ball tampering scandal meant. You know, that was something that the Prime Minister felt that it was, you know, worth coming out and talking about, you know, up to that level of discourse. A few episodes ago, we reviewed Jeff Lemon's brilliant expose on the culture of Australian cricket, which really talks about how from the very top of the organisation, from the board down, it was just a win at all costs attitude, and all costs was the spirit of the game, your opposition, and actually the people who played within the game as well. These were, you know, disposable assets just to get victories for the for Cricket Australia. There have been a few interesting changes of late, one of which is Mel Jones, the ex-international player, being appointed to the Cricket Australia board. She was the Victorian state kind of nominee. Each of the states kind of nominate someone to go onto the Cricket Australia board, and Mel Jones is the first ever woman to go onto that board, which I think is a really significant step forward for a game that is obviously traditionally very, very male dominated. She's also seen as being someone with a lot of cricketing experience, but also with her kind of quite a balanced head on her shoulders. So not being one of these ex-players who's just all about, oh, it was better back in the day, and they just, you know, again, need to just sledge harder in order to win. The other thing that's been quite interesting is the number of players who have withdrawn from the game on a temporary basis recently due to mental health issues. So Glenn Maxwell, Nick Maddison and Will Pukowski have all taken a break. Which I think is partly it's a recognition of the fact that, you know, as we've increasingly seen over the years from Jonathan Trott onwards, that playing cricket at a high level is something that can really affect your mental health. But I think the reason that so many players feel that it's okay now to come out and talk about mental health and say, look, I just need to step back from the game, is a signal of the shift within Australian cricket culture, that suddenly they feel they can do this without being, you know, written off forever and a day into the future. And I was reading an interesting article, an interview with the Aussie head of sports science, Alex Contoris, and he kind of admitted as such. He said it's really valuable that we are now in a place where players feel that they can actually talk about these things. So it feels across the board as though there has been a bit of a shift in the way that Cricket Australia thinks about itself internally on quite a positive level.
And it was also interesting to see from the coverage that it's got in the UK that this goes beyond Australia, in the sense that Virat Kohli was very quick to come out and support the players involved, which I think was helpful. Is there any question, though, that the fact that this number of players, and particularly some very young players, are having to step away from the game at this stage, suggests that there's still something wrong in the broader setup? I mean, I guess there's two ways of looking at it. Either we're just saying that actually professional sport it is very tough, does put unique pressures on people, it is very natural X number of times during your career to step away. Or is there any feeling in Australia that actually the number of these youngsters stepping away suggests that there's something more fundamental wrong with the structure?
I think it's a bit of both. I think it's the kind of thing where as soon as you start talking about it, you know, who knows who through the last 40 years actually was out there suffering under, you know, real mental health strain, but they just could never talk about it because it just wasn't the thing you did if you were a male athlete and you were tough and you were Dennis Lilly, you know. I'm not suggesting that Dennis Lilly necessarily was affected by mental health issues. But at the same time, yes, there is absolutely an acknowledgement, I think, that the... an increased willingness to address the question of what being a balanced individual and a professional athlete actually looks like, and the increasing need to balance those out in a highly pressurized environment. So I think it's a bit of both, but the fact that people are talking about it now, I think, is kind of the biggest step forward in and of itself.
From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is going to take us on a tour through the weird and wonderful world of cricketing memorabilia.
So, as anyone who's ever played the game will know, there's a lot of kit involved in cricket. And a lot of the kit ends up either sitting in the bottom of your wardrobe or it ends up in a charity shop. But If you've got a good cricketer's name attached to it, then it can end up in an auction house or on eBay or on Gumtree. And this week, I spent a bit of time rummaging around on some of those sites, looking at some of the weird and wonderful things that you can get. But before we look at that, another curious fact is actually to look at the most expensive cricket items that ever sold, or the cricket items that fetched the highest price at auction. And the third highest is, this feels like a little bit of a kind of Guinness Book of Records, you know, program now, but it's fascinating. The third highest in the bronze medal position is MS Dhoni's 2011 World Cup final bat. So this is the final where India beat Sri Lanka. Dhoni scored 91 not outs to bring the game home. And just a couple of months after that final, his bat, the bat that he used, was auctioned at a charity dinner in London, and it fetched £125,000. Now, I don't know whether to think that that's... I don't know whether I was surprised by how low or by how high that is, actually.
Well, it's fascinating because it actually, as an item, says an awful lot about India, doesn't it? You know, 2011, the Indian economy, India starting to really... grow on the world stage as sort of economic and political power. You could imagine that suddenly that there was a whole like group of businesses, a whole sort of class of wealthy Indians for whom suddenly that would be a brilliant status symbol.
Yeah, a brilliant trophy. And it was in fact a company that bought it. So a lot of these sales of kind of high-end cricket memorabilia happen as charity auctions, and businesses come in and buy it. So on this occasion, it was the Indian Global Shares and Securities firm that forked out and paid that 125 grand for the bat, and then the money went to charity, which I suppose is, you know, quite a healthy way for that to happen. Now in second place, silver medal position is possibly, and I was surprised that this wasn't the most expensive actually, was because it's perhaps the most iconic item worn by the most iconic cricketer. So it's Don Bradman's baggy green cap. So this was the cap that he actually wore when he scored his 29th Test 100 in 1948. It was the record for the largest number of Test 100s until Sunil Gavaskar broke it 35 years later. And the story of this is quite fascinating. So the cap was sold to a guy called Tim Cerisier, and Tim Cerisier had won Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And when he'd won Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, he wanted to invest his winnings in something that he thought was going to bring him back a lot of money. And so he bought this cap from Bradman's godson himself in 2003. So it had been in the family till that point. Cerisier bought it. He bought it for £200,000, which was all of his winnings, and actually a bit more, I think, from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. He thought that this one was going to be a sound investment, but actually it ended up losing a lot of money. So he ended up selling it in 2008, 5 years later, for well below the £225,000 that he was... the asking price that he was looking for. So what's interesting is that in that instance, for whatever reason, that fell in value. But actually, apparently, there are a lot of people who will recommend that if you're looking to invest, that actually cricket memorabilia is a good place to do it. Because, for instance, if you bought in the 70s or 80s copies of Wisden, the original, you know, hardback, thick doorstopper Wisdoms, you might have paid about £5 each for all of them, but a set of 10 nowadays of those would go for £10,000. So even though this feels like a bit of an episode of Cash in the Attic now, there are those, you know, quite innocent items, old Wisdoms and things like that, that now will fetch a lot of money amongst collectors.
If you compare it to something like the art industry, that there is a lot there around who is in and out of fashion. So, you know, what you obviously want to do if you're treating art as an investment rather than as a, well, I guess as art, you want to buy an artist when he's down, or he or she is down. Yes. And people are not interested and not rating. And then your hope is that X number of years later, they suddenly come back into vogue. And that's, I guess, how you make money out of it. The alternative is you get someone who's never out of vogue. You know, I don't know, a Picasso or some figure that actually has a kind of permanence. Which brings you back to Bradman and why it's kind of surprising, because you would have thought that one of the few cricketers who, you know, cricketers' stars do wax and wane over time. There are people who are sort of forgotten and then remembered, but Bradman isn't. Is it really? You know, you think, well, he is about as permanent as cricket gets.
Well, I wonder whether part of this is because Cerisier actually bought it from someone in the Bradman family. He wasn't necessarily paying a sort of market-adjusted price. He wasn't buying it from a dealer. So, therefore, that might have actually led to a sort of inflated price around the cap in the first instance. Just an interesting story about hats and cricket hats. There's a guy out there, I was reading an article in the FT, there's a retired headmaster by the name of Keith Hayhurst, who actually owns a cap that's probably got more value than that Bradman one. It's difficult to think of hats necessarily having this level of value, but he is the owner of the cap that gave its name to the phrase, "I take my cap off to you." So this is the cap worn by the Australian captain in 1884 in England, and this captain was so... This guy, the William Murdoch, the Australian captain, was so impressed by one of the English players that at the end of the game, he went up to him and he said, "I take my cap off to you." And he gave his cap to the English player. That player passed it on to his son, who passed it on to Hayhurst. So it's never been valued or auctioned, but here's a cap that's actually had a kind of measurable impact on the English language and the way that we all speak. And interesting to know if that ever were auctioned off at what price that would go. But the most expensive item, and this did surprise me, was actually a piece of cricket memorabilia that... can't be, you know, has never been used by a famous cricketer, and you'll never have heard of the person who owned it. So it's an item that was sold for £324,000 in 2005. It was auctioned off at Christie's, and it's a set of four scorebooks that belonged to a guy called Samuel Britcher. Now, Samuel Britcher was the scorer for the MCC between 1795 and 1806. So why on earth, you might ask, and I did too, would this set of four scorebooks go for £324,000? The reasons are that it was the first ever regular scorebook to be kept. So as a kind of cricket historical item, it's very important. They're also completely unique because obviously they were written by hand, so it's not as though there are a few copies of these as there are with Wisdoms and things like that. Apparently also, going back to your point about art, there are certain items that do kind of keep their value in a really significant way. So apparently books are a really, really valuable investment, and if you're looking to invest money generally, you know, first editions of books are a really valuable way of doing that. So yeah, the most expensive cricket item ever to have been sold, a set of four scorebooks. Who would have thought?
Well, I think that's it, isn't it? If you're asking people to guess, there's so much equipment you can get, so much game used equipment, that I think people would instinctively go to. But I mean, you know, we as a podcast spend much time reading and talking about cricket books, and perhaps it's appropriate in some ways that again, with such a great literature, it's the books that are the ultimate.
So if you don't have that kind of money, though, and you're looking to buy some cricket memorabilia, here are a few things that you can get. You can get a shirt worn by David Warner in the 2016 IPL for just $160. I don't know whether it's been washed or not. Maybe it would have greater value if it hadn't been washed. A limited edition flyer signed by Graham Swan will set you back 99 cents on eBay. Poor old Graham Swan. That's a bit of a slap in the face, isn't it? The other interesting thing is that if you're an ex-player who's looking to make some quick cash, well, Jeff Thompson recently teamed up with a memorabilia company to release a limited edition series of what they say to be, quote, the only one and only authentic memorabilia that Tomo has and ever will release. So you can get this awful looking, the design is horrible. It's a frame bat and ball, and the ball's embedded in the bat surrounded by scorch marks. And it's framed, signed by Tomo, $1,000 each. They say it's limited edition, but they don't say how many copies, which makes you sort of slightly suspicious about whether they're just going to keep on buying them on demand. But interesting to see that clearly when you're a retired ex-player and your name still attaches to something, of course you're hoiking out those old bats, pads, and possibly boxes from the cupboard, sticking them up there and seeing how much cash you're going to get from them. The review. And for this episode, we have been reading Absolutely Foxed, which is the autobiography of Graham Fowler, with a foreword by his dear friend Sir Ian Botham. So to refresh your memory, Graham Fowler is a Lancashire lad. He was born in Accrington in 1957. Accrington, which I think is the same town in which Bumble was born, actually. He went on to be a successful England batsman with 21 caps, ending in 1985. After he retired, he kind of kept his association with the game, set up the Centre of Excellence at Durham University, and then went on to become a commentator and an opinionated and useful voice on Twitter as well in recent times. Andy, what did you... so this is a book of kind of several parts. It talks about his life. It talks about his career as a cricketer. It talks about his life after cricket as a coach and commentator. And it also talks a lot about his mental health. What was the part of the book, I suppose, that most resonated with you in amongst all of those areas?
It's very much not a conventional biography in the sense that we're not treated to a blow by blow, game by game account, and I think sometimes that can become kind of an endurance competition rather than a pleasure. I think what stuck with me the most is actually the fact that his take on a lot of issues, and I think this very much fits the kind of persona that I think people have come to know through firstly maybe his commentary and then on social media. He has quite an unusual take on a lot of issues. So I think, you know, just to give you one example, he looks into this idea of why actually he thinks successful teams have far more arguments. He says that actually when you're winning, there becomes a sort of obsessiveness. There becomes a sort of scrapping over every detail of performance. And actually when you're losing, there's an odd togetherness in being up against it. And I thought, God, it's extremely counterintuitive, but I'm not going to challenge it on the basis that I haven't been in a cricket dressing room. I mean, one other, actually, he talks about the fact that he kind of became a cricketer by accident. The fact that, you know, he never really thought of being a professional cricketer. He just made his way up through the club levels and suddenly found himself, you know, representing Lancashire Seconds, and that was that. And again, very different to the number of players you read about, you know. Yeah. God, it was always my dream. You know, I trained obsessively. It was all I wanted to do. So, yeah, it was offbeat in an interesting way.
Yeah, there's something that's quite contrary about him in the way that he, in his approach to things. And he spends a lot of time talking about how he has absolutely no patience with certain arguments about... it's interesting, for instance, when talking of successful teams and what makes a successful team, he talks about the fact that there is actually no such thing as really as form, and certainly no such thing as form within a team. You know, he kind of, you know, very explicitly shouts down the idea that you can have a team that's on a roll, and says what does that actually mean that there's a team on a roll. And one of the things that I think is quite interesting about reading this book is that, unlike some autobiographies that will sort of just step through the details of people's career and just give you, you know, one scorecard essentially after another, that he kind of does jump into, particularly in the later stages when he's talking about coaching, he does jump into he just jumps into opinion very, very readily as well, which I think is quite useful within the book.
And I think obviously with a book like that, some opinions land better than others. I think there's the odd moment that you feel these are the sort of classic grumbles of a retired player, and others where you think, this is more innovative. It has very much been characterised in the way it was received and reviewed as a kind of a further contribution to sports writing about mental health. So I guess in the same line as Johnny Bairstow, Marcus Trezeguet's biography. I think what sets it apart is that there's something kind of impressively kind of practical and no-nonsense. It doesn't dominate the book. It's almost as if Fowler wants to say, yes, I had these issues, but I didn't let them dominate my life, and I'm not going to let them dominate my life story. So he talks, for example, about this idea of this kind of simple numerical scale he has for capturing his feelings and representing to his family, which actually, whether he knew it or not, was extremely forward thinking, because there's now a huge industry of apps that are very much built on trying to do exactly that for people, managing their mood. He also has a very moving thing about his relationship with Ian Botham and about the fact that Botham never really got his understood Fowler's depression, but he always knew how to help. He knew how to do the right thing, even though he didn't quite understand it. So, oddly, the writing about mental health is very powerful, partly because of Fowler's very practical, no-nonsense approach to facing it head-on.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well that the way that the book is constructed, so the book starts at the very beginning with a description of some of Fowler's kind of lowest times when it comes to mental health. He's a retired player. He is actually sleeping in a tent in the garden of his house, and he's spending whole days unable to get up off the sofa because he's just, you know, just doesn't have any motivation to do anything. And his wife says to him, "Look, really think you should go and see someone about this." And because the book starts there, you kind of have that frame in mind, I think, as you go through a lot of the other stories about earlier in his career. So you then quite quickly go back to the beginning of his career and some amazing descriptions of, and this was, I suppose, life in the 70s and 80s. I like to imagine that this is, you know, was the same for everyone in the 70s and 80s, that you found yourself at kind of amazing dinners with Elton John, as Fowler does. And there are these amazing descriptions of him, particularly when he's touring Australia, of, you know, being at a dinner with Elton John, this wonderful anecdote of sitting down opposite him and being terrified and kind of going, wow, this is one of the, you know, most high profile musicians of all time, and kind of admitting that to Elton John, and John saying back to him, well, actually I'm really, really terrified of meeting you guys because you guys are England cricketers. And then that ballooning into these descriptions of, you know, going out on a yacht in Sydney Harbour, and then when he's in Perth, Elton John phoning him up and saying, hey, can we have a party at your place? And then 10 minutes later, you know, a fleet of limousines turning up with a whole lot of, you know, food and champagne and caviar and a DJ and everything else. And you do, I think, because the book has been framed with this description of kind of crippling mental health, and someone who is quite, I think, uncertain of themselves, despite sometimes the stridency of their opinions, that does put a lens on some of the descriptions that kind of come subsequently, and also some of the descriptions of what life was like as a player too.
Yeah, I think it's a great distinction that even though he's not constantly talking about it, the fact that it's set up means that it's in the reader's mind as you go through the story. In the same way that he has some unusual ideas, that he has stories that go far beyond your conventional cricket biography. The one that I thought was the most moving was an on-field one where his friend Michael Holding is bowling to him. And Holding bowls a bouncer, which, you know, Fowler gets nowhere near, tries to hook, misses it by a mile. And there's kind of like, you know, laughter almost in the slip cordon about how hopelessly outpaced he is. And Holding walks up to him and, rather than intimidating him, rather kind of affectionately says, you know, put that shot away. Just kind of like, you know, almost looking out for him, which is the kind of thing you would not... you don't quite associate with Holding or perhaps any of that West Indian cohort. I should say, in terms of that, there's a very much a kind of look away now moment. There is the most graphic description in this book, and in order to avoid, you know, to protect our hard-won family-friendly rating, I certainly won't be repeating it, of Joel Garner breaking Fowler's box. Which I don't know, I think for anyone who ever sort of tells you, you know, oh, cricket, it's kind of a sort of, you know, it's a sort of friendly, kind of lovable, all white shirt sport. Read that description, it'll remind you of what a kind of brutal physical game it can be.
So it feels like in this, one of the things I enjoyed about this book is it crams a lot in, which I think is a reflection of a man who's had quite a incredibly diverse career and across a number of different parts of the game, and met some incredible incredible people as well. It's an interesting review that's quoted on the back cover that says this book will make you laugh, it'll make you cry, and it is a bit like that, you know, all the way from the descriptions of jog, you know, of breaking your box, through to what it's like to have really, you know, really severe mental illness as well. So that's absolutely foxed by Graham Fowler. It's published by Simon and Schuster. It's available wherever you get your books, I assume. And that was the 117th episode of Reverse Sweps Radio. Please do hop over onto iTunes, leave us a review, hop over onto Twitter, let us know your thoughts, and we'll look forward to seeing you for the 118th episode in a couple of weeks.